puzzles, and she has it all to herself. I blink, taking in my surroundings and noting there's an ensuite bathroom as well as a sitting room right by the sleeping area. It's the type of bedroom I'd only seen in magazines and seldom in movies. As I gawk at the beauty that is her room, Grace goes to her closet, rummaging for a short while before removing a few pieces. Two dresses, a matching set of a blouse and a pair of trousers, and something to sleep in. That's too much, I protest. I won't take more than a day's worth of clothes since I plan to get my own as soon as I get to a store. If I don't give you proper options, my mother will have my ass, she says in a deadpan voice, pushing the clothes towards me. I nod slowly. You can go there to freshen up and change. She motions to the ensuite bathroom. I give her my thanks and head inside. Taking my clothes off, I wash myself lightly before I put on one of the dresses Grace gave me, a floral white one with a cinched waist. The fit is fantastic, as is the soft material. I spend a couple of minutes simply watching myself in the wall-sized mirror and marveling at the way the dress flatters my body. Depending on the allotment of the will, maybe I'll be able to buy myself some similar ones in the future. My cheeks redden at the thought. As Allison rightly said, once I have the money, I'll be able to do anything I want. The thought of that kind of financial freedom is the only thing spurring me further despite the unease I still feel at being here. Already, I am quite disillusioned with my half-siblings, as neither seems too thrilled about my presence. August had been more circumspect, but I could sense his hesitance, too. Grace may have been rude, but she'd hinted at what everyone was thinking. I'm not welcome. Taking a deep breath, I go back to the room to find a scowling Grace tapping her foot impatiently. Took you long enough? She mumbles, her eyes skittering over my body before she's out of the door. Pursing my lips, I follow her downstairs to the dining room where everyone is already seated. It doesn't escape me to notice that Mr. Vaughn is sitting at the end of the table where the head of the family should have been. And though Leo Pierce had died, shouldn't that role befall August? Odd. But then so is his interaction with Vicky Pierce, their body language too familiar for a simple employer-employee relationship. Alas, it is not my business to speculate on their personal relationship. I'm here for the reading of the will, after which I will return home. Plastering a smile on my face, I take a seat at the table, right between August and Vicky Pierce. It doesn't take long for two servants to bring the food, placing an appetizer in front of me. Tell us more about you, Darcy, Mrs. Pierce speaks first. There's nothing much to tell, I say as I give them a short summary of what I do and what my credentials are. I don't go into further detail than what is already on paper and what they are undoubtedly familiar with. I must say, it was a shock to hear that my dear Leo had another child, she sighs. You mean that he cheated on you? Grace brazenly asks.
Grace?
Both August and Mrs. Pierce intone at the same time. You know it wasn't like that. We were separated at the time, and he moved to Boston while I stayed here, she says as she wipes the corners of her mouth in a delicate manner. I can't condemn him for finding someone else when we didn't think we were going to get back together. Mrs. Pierce goes on to relate what had happened during that time, and as I glance around the table, no one seems to truly pay attention as she prattles on, almost as if this was a rehearsed speech, prepared only for my sake. Please don't think I hold anything against you, Darcy. You're a part of Leo, just like my August and Grace, and we're very happy to have you here. She reaches to touch my hand at the same time I pick up my glass of water. Thank you, I murmur, taking a sip and slowly leaning away from her. I don't know what it is about her, but I've never had such an adverse reaction to someone before. She seems nice, if not a little fake, but she strikes me as a regular trophy wife, not an axe murderer. I have one question. I turn towards Mr. Vaughn. What was the cause of death? Your letter didn't mention why he died. Everyone is quiet. The only sound in the room is the heavy breathing that echoes in the spacious room. A heart attack, Mrs. Pierce says, at the same time as Mr. Vaughn responds with,
Brain damage.
More silence. Glancing around, my eyes flutter in confusion. From the corner of my eye, I spot August tightly holding on to the knife, almost bending the tip. Mrs. Pierce's lips are pressed into a tight line, while Mr. Vaughn narrows his eyes at me.
It was both a heart attack and brain damage.
He speaks slowly, almost as if he's imparting the information to everyone present.
He had a heart attack, after which we tried to resuscitate. We got a pulse, but he'd been gone too long without oxygen to his brain, so he was declared brain dead.
Nodding slowly, I bring the glass to my lips, taking a sip of water as I covertly watch the four strangers around the table. In what I think is an unprecedented moment, their eyes are set on each other, their expressions naked, malice and greed dripping from them. As if I'd been dumped in a forest teeming with wolves fighting for dominance, for the first time, I'm struck by a thought. Whatever the contents of the will, I'm not the only enemy in the house. Almost as if recognizing the mounting tension at the table, Mrs. Pierce diffuses the situation by shifting the conversation to the late Leo Pierce and sharing some anecdotes of him. Soon, the dinner is finished, and Mr. Vaughn lets me know that he will drive me to my house. My house? I exclaim, taken aback.
The key I sent you, Miss Darcy. It belongs to a property north of here that Leo owned. Vicky and I have prepared it for you, since we didn't want you to feel uncomfortable living with strangers.
He explains.
You'll have the privacy you need, since the following days could prove to be rather demanding.
He says as he details the upcoming schedule. Tomorrow is the funeral, while the reading of the will would take place the day after tomorrow. Oh, thank you. That is very thoughtful of you. I thank both Mr. Vaughn and Mrs. Pierce, and after saying goodbye, I find myself once more in the back of the car as Mr. Vaughn drives towards the destination, 12 Astor Place. It's soon evident that by the northern part of the town, he meant at the other end. We drive for close to 10 minutes, and for a small town, that is a long distance. Despite the darkening sky, the more we drive, the clearer the view of the famous Fairydale Hill is, as is the view of the majestic Hale Manor Mr. Vaughn had mentioned. He hadn't been lying when he'd described the manor resembling a castle. Though built in a neoclassical style, its grandeur and sheer size make it qualify for the title. Even from afar, its imposing build and the accompanying scenery make for a striking picture. As we approach further, sparks of excitement spread through my body, my belly tightening with anticipation. Besides the tourist attractions in Boston, I haven't seen many historical buildings. I certainly haven't visited any in depth, but hopefully, before my sojourn here ends, I will be able to visit the grounds of the manor. I'm so enraptured by the sight of the manor as night falls that I barely register the car coming to a stop.
We're here,
Mr. Vaughn suddenly mentions. Shaking myself back to the present, I slowly get out of the car. I take in my surroundings, goosebumps appearing all over my skin at the bleakness of the location. Hale Manor might seem like the cradle of sophistication up on its lonely hill, but here it's anything but that. There are only two buildings as far as I can see, 12 Astor Place and another building across the street. Other than that, a field stretches on both sides of the makeshift road. It's not even paved. Good Lord, but I'd been so focused on admiring the manor that I hadn't realized we'd left the more civilized area. This is right at the outskirts of the town. This is rather far from town, isn't it? I ask hesitantly.
Not at all.
Mr. Vaughn comes by my side, his features stern.
The town is 15 minutes a-walkin' in that direction.
He points towards the direction we'd come from.
That's the Hale Manor, and there's a cliff that leads to the ocean.
I purse my lips in consternation. And that? I turn to point at the building on the other side of the road. Different in architecture, its sharp angles, pointed arches, and stained glass suggest a Gothic style.
That's the old church. Don't worry about it. It's locked. No one uses it anymore, but No one wants to repurpose it either. It dates to the 17th century.
He adds, and I remember him telling me about it. I nod absent-mindedly, though inside I can't help but be put off by the entire thing. Is there no other place in town I can sleep at for a couple of nights? Though the house in front of me is lovely, the fact that I'm so far away from town and across the street from an old church that looks more creepy than beautiful despite its assuredly fascinating history doesn't make me look forward to my stay here. A shiver travels down my back the more I think of it. The Hale Manor doesn't look as close either, despite the optical illusion given by its location, and that situates me in the middle of nowhere, in a foreign town surrounded by strangers. No, not a good idea, and I tell Mr. Vaughn exactly that. I can't possibly stay here alone.
This is the house your father wanted you to have, Miss Darcy. It's not a coincidence that I gave you the key. It'll be yours in a few days' time.
I blink, not expecting to hear that. Are you sure? He nods.
I've been Leo's man of affairs for decades. He wanted you to have a place to stay here in Fairydale, since it's your home, too.
He smiles then, a rehearsed smile that doesn't reach his eyes. Instead, his gaze is on me, waiting for me to agree with him. Is there no hostel? I rephrase. Though the chances of a town this small having a hostel are slim at best, why can't he understand that the area is creepy, that I'm a single woman in the middle of a field? How could I possibly accept to stay here when I doubt there is even a telephone for miles? Given the position of the house, I'm most certain a pastor must have lived here with his family in the past, when the old church was still operational. And I don't think I want to sleep in a house that...
What are you so scared of, Miss Darcy?
He interrupts my thoughts, asking me in a gravelly voice, one that makes the hairs on my body stand up. Instinctively, I take a step back as I hug my arms to my chest. I'll be alone, I grumble. What if someone tries to break in? What if... He puts a hand up, interrupting me.
So you're concerned about safety?
I nod fervently.
Come,
he says in a tone bordering on exasperation as he tells me to give him the key. I do so and I watch as he opens the door, the floors immediately creaking under his weight. I visibly wince at the sound. St. Russell's may have been an older building, too, but at least there I'd been surrounded by people. Flicking the light in the hallway, Mr. Vaughn beckons me inside. The interior is more modern than the outside, but it's clear no one's lived in the house for years, maybe decades.
Look.
He points to the door and the many locks on the wall.
If you secure it, no one will be able to come inside. And besides, despite those nasty rumors about crime, Fairydale is a very peaceful town. Our residents have never been accused of anything. It's the outsiders that get in trouble with the law.
He explains matter-of-factly, but there's a small twitch in his cheek as he regards me. I see, I reply softly. What else can I say? That I will not, under any circumstance, sleep in this place? I could try, but everything about his countenance tells me he isn't amenable to arranging anything else for me, and that means it's either this place or nothing.
The house has a living room downstairs and two bedrooms upstairs. You can choose the one you like the most. The water is clean and potable, and there is gas and some canned food in the cupboards. Vicky made sure to stock up the kitchen for you.
My eyes widen in surprise at hearing that. Thank you, I murmur, now feeling a little ashamed about my earlier outburst. The last thing I want them to think of me is that I'm a spoiled brat that's only after the money, which, admittedly, the latter part is true. However, they have received me well and have gone through a lot of trouble to ensure my stay here would be comfortable. I'm not about to turn up my nose at that.
The funeral starts at noon tomorrow. I will come get you at 11:30. Good night.
He doesn't wait for me to respond before he's out the door, leaving me alone in this ancient... Fine, not as ancient as the church across the road. House. The door closes with a thud, and I hurry to latch every lock in place. Only when I'm sure that the door is thoroughly locked do I move, going to the windows to ensure they are also closed shut. Still, the fact that no one can come in doesn't seem to calm my nerves. My heart is beating loudly in my chest. You can do this, Darcy, I tell myself in an attempt to cheer myself up. Think about the money, and the things you can do with it. A vacation in England, or France, or even a cruise on the Mediterranean. You'll visit Versailles, sunbathe in Capri, and amble around the Acropolis. The more I imagine the future, the more determined I am. If this is the only way I can get that money, I'll do it. Nodding to myself, I feel some of the earlier unease leave me as I take a few long, deep breaths. When I have myself under control with my determination soaring, I decide to check the house out. After all, according to Mr. Vaughn, this is to be mine. Officially mine. I roll my eyes at that thought. It's unlikely I'll ever come to Fairydale after the division of assets. The first room I enter is the kitchen. Dropping the bag with the clothes I'd borrowed from Grace on a chair, I inspect the cupboards, confirming that there is plenty of food, certainly not for one person staying for a few days. All the compartments are full, almost as if someone had planned for the apocalypse. Chuckling to myself, I move to check the fridge, and opening it, I find fresh produce, meat, and vegetables. Vicky really thought of everything, didn't she? A little hungry since I hadn't eaten much at the Pierce house, I make myself a small sandwich before I set out to explore the rest of the house. Going to the staircase, I find the light switch on the wall, flicking it and the one in the hallway when I reach the second floor. With the house bathed in light, I feel more confident. There are three doors on the second floor, one that leads to a bathroom and the other two which lead to bedrooms. I check out each bedroom in turn, settling on the one closer to the bathroom, since I'll likely be scared to walk the longer distance at night. There is a double bed in the middle of the room, a big closet and a desk by the window. The sheets on the bed are clean, an odd floral scent clinging to the material. Despite the not-so-ideal circumstances, my lips tug up in a smile, and before I can help myself, I jump on the bed, a giggle escaping me when it bounces with me. It's the first time I'll have such a big bed to myself, and a giddiness suffuses me at the thought. Rolling around in bed, I giggle more as I feel the soft sheets against my skin. Yes, this is the beginning of something new. And after all the weirdness of today, I feel good about the future. I can feel it, somewhere deep within me, that this experience will change my entire life. A little more rolling against the fresh linens before I decide I should take a shower and call it a day. After all, I'm sure tomorrow will be busy. Getting out of bed, I take out the nightgown Grace had loaned me and I go to the bathroom. Just like the kitchen, the bathroom has soap, shampoo, towels, and toilet paper. Glad that I'll be able to thoroughly scrub all the grease from the travel, I close the door to the bathroom, locking it just in case, before I shed all my clothes and pin my hair up. Moving to the tub, I turn on the water, adjusting the temperature. When I'm satisfied with the warmth, I get inside, pulling the curtain and making myself comfortable. The tub continues to fill with water as I soak in its warmth. Leaning back, I release a weary sigh as I close my eyes and let the stress melt away. How long has it been since I've had a proper bath? Though St. Russell has good sanitary conditions, it doesn't have a tub. We have to shower quickly as per the allotted quota of hot water. I've never had the chance to relax like this. The only times I've had a proper, relaxing bath had been when Sister Anne and Sister Mary had allowed me to use their quarters. Thoroughly soaked in, I reach for the soap, but just as my fingers brush against it, a shadow moves in the corner of my eye, right behind the curtain. Startled, I whip my head around, instinctively backing away. Nothing. There's nothing. Just to be sure, I wrench the curtain aside, revealing the same thing. Nothing. Breathing hard, my pulse skyrockets the more I stare at the white curtain, certain I'd seen something move. I'm going crazy, I mumble to myself. It must be all those books I've been reading and the fact that I'm alone in a strange environment. Catherine's silly notions come to mind, and I mentally berate myself for acting like her. There's no such thing as ghosts, I say out loud, almost as if I'm willing it to be true. But ghosts do not exist. Everything is in my mind, and in the fanciful notions years of Gothic literature have created. There is no crazy woman living in the attic, just as there is no Rebecca to haunt me. Even though the rational part of my brain believes that, there's also the other part, the superstitious one that sees everything as an omen, and since arriving in Fairydale, I've had plenty of them. No, I shake my head, my lips tight in a tense line. I won't go down that road again. It had happened to me once before, right after my mother had died. I'd been new to the orphanage and, quite honestly, petrified. I couldn't sleep at night, and at some point I started seeing a shadowy figure watching over me while I slept. That had lasted for almost a year. At first, I'd told the nuns, only to be assured there was no one there, that the other girls sleeping in the same room could not see anything. After I'd been properly admonished for inventing ghost stories to scare everyone else, I'd stopped talking about it, until eventually the shadowy figure had disappeared. Now it feels like a distant memory. But back then, it had been terrifying, just as much as the fact that no one had believed me, instead making fun of me and calling me crazy. Yet the odd thing hadn't been the fact that I'd seen such an apparition, for I am sure there had been something. It had been that though I'd been scared because it was something unnatural, the entity itself had not felt threatening. In fact, sometimes it seemed as though it had been looking over me while I slept. To this day, I've had a hunch that it might have been my mother trying to help me cope with her death, in her own ghostly way. Maybe it's silly. Maybe I'm too much like Catherine. But I prefer to believe that rather than think I was crazy, that I'm still crazy. Getting out of the tub, I dry myself with a towel before I put on the nightgown. All the while, though I can see I am alone in the bathroom, I can't shake this feeling that someone is watching me. The sensation has me turning around a couple of times, confirming that there is no one around. Huffing out a breath, I go back to the room, getting under the clean sheets and forcing myself to go to sleep. Yet a couple of hours later, and I'm still twisting and turning, sleep proving to be elusive. One glance at my watch, and I note it's close to midnight. Drat it, I curse softly. Lying flat on my back, I stare at the ceiling, wondering if counting sheep would help. Ready to give up, I start. One sheep, two sheep, three. I trail off when a cacophonous sound blasts through the air. Sitting up straight, my eyes widen, all my fatigue gone in the blink of an eye. The first note is a deep bass one, followed by a succession of softer notes. Music. It's music. At this hour, in the middle of nowhere. But as I keep on listening, I recognize the quality of the sound as belonging to an organ, and who else would have an organ but the old church? I swallow hard. Mr. Vaughn said no one uses it, and considering the remote location, who could it be at this hour? Someone playing a prank? That's the most likely scenario. And as soon as that thought crosses my mind, so does something else. What if this is all an elaborate scheme to get me to run off and relinquish my hold on my inheritance? What if the Pierces know this house will be passed down to me and want to prevent that? I would have felt bad accusing them in my mind had I not seen the way they behaved at dinner, and the hidden glances they shot each other when they thought I wasn't watching. A quiet resolution settles over me as I jump out of bed, quickly taking off my nightgown and putting on one of the day dresses. After I put on my shoes, I leave the room, my stride determined as I go down the stairs. If they want to play with me, it's high time they realized I'm not a weakling, nor am I someone they can bully. Removing all the locks on the door, I exit the house, crossing the road to the old church. The music is still blasting in the air, the stillness of the night making it seem even louder. Yet, as I stop in front of the church's entrance, the music changes. This time, I recognize the melody as Bach's Toccata, the sound hauntingly beautiful and evocative. I freeze, my skin erupting in goosebumps as my hand hovers over the door's rusty knob. The sound bursts through the night, surrounding me in a protective cocoon, until all I want is to preserve the melody and let it play ad infinitum. Yet the idea that this could be a senseless prank incites my temper again. My hands clench into fists, and before I change my mind, I stride forward, wrenching the door open. To my surprise, it gives way easily. Shouldn't it have been locked? That only solidifies my decision to march forward. If it's not locked, then surely someone must have opened it. There is a small arcade at the entrance of the church. Everything is bathed in darkness, the only light that of the moon as it filters through the richly colored stained glass. The atmosphere is eerily intoxicating, especially with the music echoing in the background. "Is there someone there?" I ask, though my voice can't cut over the loud music. One foot in front of the other, I move forward until I reach the nave of the church. On each side, there's an aisle. Though the church didn't look too big from the outside, the inside, with its high vaults, makes it look enormous. For a town church, it's certainly too big, and it makes me wonder who would have built it, a wealthy patron? There is a small gallery on each side of the church, behind which there are sets of stained glass, all capturing the moonlight perfectly and reflecting it along the nave. At the far end of the church is the choir, and as I take a few more steps, I spot the organ in the corner, oriented with the back towards the aisles. The music is still playing, the same melody on repeat, but when I reach the middle of the nave, it suddenly stops. My eyes widen, and thinking the culprit saw me inside and is ready to make his escape, I dash towards the choir. In just a few seconds, I'm right by the organ. A little out of breath, I turn the corner. "Got you!" I trail off when I see there is absolutely no one. What's more, the fallboard is covering the keys, a thick, even layer of dust settled on top of it, a sign that no one had touched it in a long time. "What the..." I whisper, unnerved. But I don't have time to dwell on it, as something moves in my field of vision right before the sound of punctured steps echoes in the church. "Wait!" I call out, convinced there was someone inside. I chase the sound until I reach the main entrance again. The door is closed shut, and as I open it, the creaking noise makes it clear no one had gone out. What the... My heart is beating loudly in my chest, my thoughts racing at the speed of light. Who was it? Who the hell was it? I'm past caring that I'm cursing in the house of the Lord, even if it's not out loud. I'm past caring about anything but the fact that I've never felt greater fear before. If it was indeed a prank, then well done. I am well and thoroughly terrified. The sheer oddity of the situation, coupled with my increasing anxiety, propels me to leave the church. I look around left and right as I step onto the small pathway leading back to the road, but I am so focused on avoiding any no-good doer that I don't realize when I walk straight into a solid wall. "What?" I yelp, jumping back a step and ready to scream so loud the entire town would hear me.
"Easy."
A man's harsh voice penetrates my mental fog. But it's too late, as my self-preservation has kicked in, together with the moves I'd learned from Seven Samurai. My fist flies towards the man's face before I can stop it. On the bright side, if it makes contact, then it's likely not a ghost. Alas, it does not make contact with his face, but not because he's not corporeal, but because his own hand closes over my clenched fist before it can reach its destination. My mouth drops open in shock, and flabbergasted, I can only stare at him. "You are not a ghost," I state, quite foolishly. His mouth curves up in a smile that threatens to make my insides explode. From fear or fascination, I don't know. He's probably a foot taller than I am, but even in the darkness of the night, I can make out his features. His dark hair and eerily light eyes. So light, in fact, that they seem to glow white in the moonlight. He's built like a tank, all muscles and hard edges. No wonder it felt like I had hit a wall. "Who are you?" I whisper. My fist is still in his hand, and a shiver of awareness travels down my back as his touch registers on my body. Before I can think it through, I pull back, keeping my eyes still on him.
"Not a ghost?"
He tilts his head, studying me with a lopsided smile that must work wonders on the female population. "Well," I clear my throat, chasing away all remnants of fear, for now. Pushing one finger against his, very, very hard abdominals, I nod to myself. Clearly not a ghost. He's still smirking at me, his gaze indulgent, as is his half-smile. Not wanting to look like a besotted fool, though it is my first time seeing such a fine male specimen, I push my chin up and regard him with a pointed brow. "Who are you, and what are you doing here at night, alone?" I narrow my eyes at that. Yes, he might not be a ghost, but he could still be a criminal, and I have no way of defending myself. Alarm bells go off in my head, just as I look around for a potential weapon.
"You can bash me over the head with that metal bar,"
he states, his voice a deep drawl that makes love to my ears. Makes love to my ears? Since when did I become so poetic? I may be an English teacher, but I've never had a gift for words. You didn't find the perfect muse before. Straightening my back, I ignore my inner voice as I grab the bar he pointed to. "I will if you don't identify yourself," I say firmly, proud of myself for not stumbling over my words, not even once. He chuckles at that, and before I know it, he's in front of me, so close I can smell him, a smoky, arcane scent that I can't pin down.
"You're interesting,"
he notes in the same thick voice. I gulp down. "I'll be even more interesting when I do bash your brains in," I proclaim with all the confidence I can muster. He might be a handsome devil, but beauty is a cover for many dark things. After all, Lucifer was at one point the epitome of perfection. The stranger smiles again, this time more pronounced. Leaning forward until he's on eye level with me, his breath fans across my lips, his gaze never leaving mine.
"Ale,"
he states.
"Caleb Ale."
I stare at him for what feels like an eternity before I realize he just told me his name. He's a Hale. A Hale. That means... "You live there?" I ask, pointing towards the Grand Manor house.
"Indeed,"
he drawls, a wolfish grin on his face.
"And I assume you're the new troublemaker in town."
I frown at his choice of words. "Troublemaker?"
"Troublemaker, i.e., one that stirs trouble,"
he says, reciting the definition to me. "I didn't ask what it was. I asked you why." I grit my teeth, snapping at him for the first time, just as I raise the metal bar in his direction. If there is one thing I cannot stand, it's when men take jabs at my intelligence.
"And the kitten has claws,"
he laughs, leaning back.
"You'll find out soon enough, Darcy O'Sullivan. In any event, pleased to meet you."
Easily removing the metal bar from my hand, he thrusts it aside, grabbing my hand in his and shaking it. I cannot move as I simply stare at him, and the way his proximity unnerves me unlike anything else.
"Welcome back to Fairydale."
Chapter 4. His voice echoes in my ears as I dash across the road, getting inside the house and closing the door, making sure all the locks are latched in place. My breathing is erratic as I run up the stairs to the bedroom, closing that door and locking it, too. And still, I don't feel safe. My entire body is primed for fight, almost as if it knows my life is in danger before my mind can rationalize it. Yet I can't ignore the conflicting feelings taking shape inside of me. Horror, fear, longing. I gulp, discomfort settling deep in my stomach. And before I can help myself, my feet take me to the big window facing the old church. Pulling the curtain aside, I peek outside. My mouth forms an O as I come face to face with him. Caleb Hale. He's in the middle of the road, his face tipped upwards, his eyes on my window. On me. My eyes flutter in shock, and though the moonbeams are the only source of light, I can almost swear I note another smirk on his face. He's just standing there, watching me, knowing I am watching. Slowly, he brings his hand to his forehead in a mock salute. All the while, the same smile remains in place, one that is both chilling and alluring. Then, just like that, he turns and leaves, walking up the road towards the manor house. My heart is in my throat as I finally duck, a few moments too late. Yet as I'd met his gaze, it had been almost as if I were caught in a spell, one that kept me rooted to the spot and unable to do anything but focus my attention on him. And that is the crux of the matter. There is something oddly appealing about him, something magnetic, raw and unrestrained. Enough so that even when my doubts were overflowing my mind, he held a certain power over me, befuddling me with his slow, deliberate movements and secretive smiles. Now, as moments pass, my mind, too, becomes clearer. Clear enough that a myriad of questions assails me. What the hell happened at the old church? Had it been Caleb who'd been playing the organ? There had been someone else in the church with me, of that I am sure. And with Caleb's appearance there not a moment later, it stands to reason that it could have been him. Maybe it was a prank after all. Perhaps there is a secret door out of the church and he'd used it to spook me. Well, spook me he did. I'm still shivering from the encounter. Not only had his appearance been fortuitous, but there had been something about his manner, beyond his admittedly good looks. Alas, I don't want to dwell on that anymore, not when it might become the source of my nightmares later tonight. Making sure the window is latched to, I pull the curtains to ensure no one can peek inside before I change once more into the nightgown. This time, as I lay in bed, I will myself to think only of the good times ahead. April, 1789. Havisham House, Kent. Mama and Papa are arguing again. Usually they are rarely in the same place to be able to get on each other's nerves, but since we've arrived at Havisham, they haven't stopped arguing. It's to the extent that their voices echo in the entire house when it happens. My lady, you should have been abed by now. Mary, my lady's maid, chides when she sees me at the top of the stairs. How can I? I whisper. No one will be able to sleep until they resolve their issue. Mary purses her lips. I'm afraid it shan't be too soon, she says, the corners of her mouth tipping up. I let out a giggle. The servants, too, know how difficult my parents can get, and they do everything in their power to avoid getting on their bad side. Their marriage had not been one of choice, but rather one of obligation. From what I'd gathered from gossip, Papa had gotten Mama pregnant, and he'd been forced to wed her. Back then, he'd only been a third son, unlikely to ever inherit, and he'd been adamant that he would never marry. Nevertheless, my grandfather had made sure he got to the altar and said his vows. That he'd never respected them, well, that is another matter altogether. Most people think that because I am young, I do not understand what's happening around me, but it's because they never mind me much that they don't realize I notice more than most. A few years after my birth, Papa had become the first in line for the succession of the Marquisate, and with his father's poor health, it hadn't been long before he'd become the Marquis of Havisham. I can't say for sure if the infidelities began around that time, or maybe not one moment after he'd married my mother. At this point, it's common knowledge that the Marquis has his pick of mistresses, sometimes not even bothering to hide the fact by inviting them to events and flaunting them in front of my mother. That has been one of their main conflicts over the years. My mother may have been in love with him at some point, but she'd been quickly cured of the notion when she'd seen his true nature. Every time he took a new lover, he not only embarrassed her publicly, but also made her the talk of the town. Mary tries to persuade me to return to my chamber when I suddenly hear my name. "Leave Elizabeth out of this!" Mama yells. Shaking my head at Mary, I tiptoe my way down the stairs and towards Papa's study. Not wanting to leave me alone in case I got caught, Mary trails quietly behind me. The door to the study is slightly ajar, the light inside the room shining bright despite the late hour of the night. My mother is the only one visible from the angle of the door, and I cannot help but notice her tense countenance and the lines that mar her face. "She's going to be presented at court in less than a month. If you do that, you're ruining her future." Fiona, the Marchioness of Havisham, says through gritted teeth.
"Ruining her future?"
My father William repeats angrily.
"I'm ensuring her future. Do you think anyone else is going to marry her? She's bloody daft, Fiona."
I barely stifle a gasp at his words. It's not the first time I've been referred to as such, but I'd never heard the word come out of Papa's mouth. And despite our strained relationship, it hurts.
"She's not daft, and you know it."
Fiona points her finger at him.
"She's just different."
"If it weren't for the extra wages we pay our staff, everyone would have already known how different she is. That she spends her time talking to animals like a bloody bedlamite."
"And that's why you've decided Clifford will do. He's 40 to her 17. For goodness sake, he's a swine."
"But he's a rich swine, Fiona."
William sighed impatiently.
"He's already seen her, and he is willing to accept her. He only wants an heir and a spare, and he won't bother her again."
"You mean he'll lock her somewhere in the country, like you plan to do with me?"
"Don't bring your own frustrations into this. Elizabeth would have had to marry at some point. I've merely secured her a match sooner,"
he states matter-of-factly. I'm frozen by the door, the topic of the conversation slowly sinking in. My father wants to marry me off, to Lord Clifford.
"So God help me, William, if you go through with this, if you dare give my precious daughter to that pox-ridden bastard, I'll gut you. I'll bloody gut you myself, even if they hang me."
My father's nostrils flare in anger, and as he takes a step towards Mother, I fear he's going to strike her. Instead of cowering, she regards him squarely in the eye, daring him to do it. I blink in shock at the scene in front of me. Just as he raises his hand against her, he suddenly strikes the shelf next to her.
"She's marrying Clifford, and it's final. He's coming at the end of the weekend for the ball. There will be a 2-week courtship after which the banns will be read. This is final, Fiona. Don't you think to disobey me on this, or you will regret it."
"How can I regret anything more than having married you?"
William lets out a dry laugh.
"Let's see if you're still as determined when Richard comes home from Eton."
He's in my direct field of view, and there's no mistaking the pure evil radiating from him as he smiles down at my mother. Despite her stubbornness and determination, if he's threatening her with Richard, I don't know if she'll be so eager to rally for me anymore. Having heard everything I needed to, I silently trudge my way back to my bedroom. I'd always known my father would have the last say in my marriage, but I'd never thought things would progress so quickly, and so unpleasantly. He won't let me make my debut at court because he thinks I will embarrass him. Instead, he'll just wash his hands of me at the first opportunity. That night, I wish I could cry. but the tears won't come. The first day of the house party is in full swing after everyone had arrived early in the afternoon, though I am not allowed at the nightly festivities, since I have not made my official debut yet. My father had instructed me that I am to allow Lord Clifford to spend time with me during the day. I hadn't argued with him, simply because I knew no good could come out of a conflict, especially since I've seen the toll the entire situation has taken on my mother. She may not know I listened in to the conversation, but I can note the weariness on her face, as well as the fact that Dorothy, her lady's maid, had sent for laudanum and a combination of herbs best used for sleep remedies. Mama hasn't been sleeping, and I am certain it's because of the entire Lord Clifford debacle. Please reconsider, my lady. Mary tries to reason with me as I dress in the darkest clothes I own, so I can be as inconspicuous as possible. I need to see with my own two eyes, Mary. I want to see this Lord Clifford, and why my mother is so anxious at the thought of me marrying him. I don't tell her that I'm equally as terrified. Mama wouldn't be so vehemently against the marriage if she didn't know there was something wrong with him. From what I recall, Lord Clifford had visited Havisham a few times to meet with my father, but I'd only seen him from afar, and I'd never taken notice of it. I'd never had reason to. And quite frankly, I don't want to marry anyone. I'm content by myself and with my animals. So what if everyone thinks I'm daft? If I had only one cottage by the woods, I would lead a peaceful existence, grateful to be left alone by everyone.
But if you're caught...
I won't be, I assure her. Please don't worry. If anyone checks on me, please tell them I'm asleep. I instruct her, motioning to the pillows I'd piled under the sheet to make it look like a human form. When Mary at last agrees to help me, I use the servant's door to sneak out of my room, going out the stairs and then exiting the house and heading to the main lawn. The ball is in 2 days, but every night there is a soiree for the guests. Mary, who'd been watching for the guests, had already spotted Lord Clifford and had described him to me as well as what he is wearing for this evening. A deep, plum-coloured vest that should help me identify him easier. As I'd told her, I only want to see with my own eyes the man I'm supposed to marry. Maybe it's my innate curiosity, or maybe there's something more to it. The last push I need to think about before doing something drastic. So drastic, in fact, that I would be ruined in the eyes of society. A garden stretches in front of the double doors that lead to the drawing room, where most people are already gathered. Luckily, my father pays his gardener a pretty sum to keep the trees in perfect condition and oddly looking shapes. As I move, they give me cover, helping me go undetected. There is little light, though. The garden path is set ablaze by a multitude of candles, as is the inside of the house. The rest, though, is bathed in darkness. Reaching my desired spot, I have an unobstructed view of the drawing room. My eyes search for the plum-coloured vest, and though at first I cannot spot him, a few minutes later, Lord Clifford appears within my field of view. He's just as Mary had described. Greasy greying hair and a visage that has multiple skin lesions. Although I cannot make out everything in great detail since I am at least a dozen paces away from the glass doors, the redness is evident against the white of his skin. I gulp down, pain erupting in my throat as if I'd swallowed pieces of glass. My mother's words echo in my ears. Pox-ridden. I may be innocent, but with father's blatant affairs and his sometimes penchant for light skirts, I'd heard the term pox more than enough to know it's something you get from dallying with doxies. Bile rises up my throat, and I barely stop myself from casting my accounts at that very moment. That is supposed to be my husband. The husband who will have full rights over my person, over my body. Who will touch me. Shaking my head vehemently, I step back. My curiosity has been well assuaged, and I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad one. All I know is that I'd rather be dead than allow that man to lay one single finger on me. I'm close to the servant's entrance when I hear a soft meow. Turning, I spot a little ball of fur nestling next to one of Father's odious trees. "What do we have here?" I murmur, my escape briefly forgotten. Dropping to my knees, I pat my hands on my thighs as I beckon the little cat to me. At first, he releases another meow, his eyes flashing red, but eventually he decides to trust me, taking a few steps until he reaches my side. I don't make to touch him yet, giving him time to smell me and get used to my presence. He's all black with a small tuft of white hair on the top of his head, the only recognizable thing about him in the darkness of the night. My lips tip up in a smile when he brushes his head against my knee. Another meow, and I know it's his way of letting me know I can touch him. Bringing my hand to his small head, I pat him slowly. "You're such a pretty little thing," I whisper, already thinking how I could keep him. My father hates animals, and he's prohibited me time and time again from spending time with them. He's afraid someone is going to see me interact with them and come to the same conclusion he had, that I'm daft because I speak to the animals as if I'm waiting for them to answer back. "But you understand what I'm saying, don't you? You may not answer me, but if you could, you would tell me that you like my touch. Isn't that right?" I coo in a soft voice, getting a meow as a reply.
"He's wondering if you have any food."
A manly voice startles me. My eyes go wide as I lose my balance and fall on my bottom. "Who's there? Show yourself!" I demand immediately, just as fear blooms in my chest at the thought that news of this escapade will reach my father's ears. A figure draped in shadows appears from behind one of the trees. At first, I can't make out who it is or what he looks like, but as he takes another step, my mouth parts in awe.
"My apologies, my lady."
He gives me a formal bow, yet I can't seem to react. Not when my eyes are affixed to his form and the oddest visage I've ever seen. Yet it's not odd in a bad way, merely in an unusual, unique, and fascinating way. He's dressed all in black, eschewing any color that others would have been eager for. But it all contrasts with his hair, the whitest shade of blonde I've ever seen, and longer than the current fashion allows. I can't quite make out the shade of his eyes from this distance, but they look to be a light blue. The more I regard him, the more handsome he becomes right under my gaze. "Who are you?" I ask in a whisper, barely able to get my bearings together. Though I'm not wearing a corset, my breathing feels as constricted as if I wore the tightest contraption. My pulse is racing, and I can feel the heat climb up my cheeks, undoubtedly painting them the deepest red. And for that, I'm thankful for the cover of the night, otherwise this stranger would see just how flustered I am in his presence. "I should go," I suddenly murmur. "It's not proper to be alone with a gentleman." I make the excuse as I get to my feet. Yet I can't find it in me to leave Mr. Meow behind, so I tuck him in the crook of my elbow, turning to leave.
"How do you know?"
he suddenly asks, stepping closer. I stop in my tracks.
"That I'm a gentleman,"
he continues, a hint of a smile in his voice. I half turn, the corner of my mouth tugging up. "Then all the more reason why it wouldn't be proper to be alone with you."
And are you proper all the time?
I blink, confused by his question. At the same time, Mr. Meow starts struggling in my arms, lodging his claws in my arm. Giving a small yelp, I release him, watching as he races away into the dark of the night. "It's all your fault." I level him with a harsh stare, taking one step towards him. "You scared Mr. Meow," I accuse. Though if I'm perfectly honest, this is merely the best excuse I could come up with to get closer, to see him from up close. And just as I'd imagined, his features are otherworldly. Chiseled cheekbones, straight patrician nose, and those light blue eyes that regard me as if he could see right into my soul.
"Mr. Meow?"
He raises a brow, a lock of white hair falling on his forehead. It's then that I realize several things. His hair isn't powdered, nor is he wearing a wig. No, his hair is white, despite the fact that he doesn't look a day over 30. When I don't reply, he chuckles.
I think that's my cue that you're not all proper, are you? No one cavorting with stray cats in the middle of the night can be very proper.
He murmurs with amusement, his eyes never leaving mine. What is it to you if I'm proper or not? You still have not answered my question. Who are you?
Who do you want me to be, Charlie? Tell me, and maybe I'll make that true.
He drawls, his hand coming up to my face, but hovering over my skin instead of touching me. You're being rather presumptuous, mon cher. I fire back, narrowing my eyes at him. He could very well be a rogue out for a tryst in the gardens, and instead of his intended, he came across me.
You're wrong,
he suddenly says, just as one cold finger touches my chin, tipping it up so I look him in the eye.
I'm not here for anyone else.
He smiles, showing white, even predatory teeth. How did you know?
You called for me.
He leans forward, whispering in my ear.
You're so cold for me. So, make your wish. What is it you want, Lizzie mine?
My lips part in shock. Though he'd called me Cherie before, this term of endearment seems so much more intimate, so much more alluring. What are you talking about? I clear my throat, trying my best not to succumb to the spellbinding effect his deep, rusty voice has on my senses.
You call, and I come.
He continues, his breath caressing my ear, its warmth seeping into my skin. Yet he doesn't touch me further. His body doesn't meet mine, though this madness inside of me wishes it would do so. You're mad, I accuse lightly, though I seem to be the one suffering from the malady.
Are we not all a little mad, Lizzie mine?
He draws back, a gentle smile on his face, one that's shadowed by great sadness.
But what if my madness recognizes yours?
He asks, stunning me into silence. For what feels like an eternity, my eyes are lost in his, my breath coming out in short spurts and meeting his in the middle. There's an intense feeling of déjà vu that washes over me, almost as if this meeting had taken place 1,000 times before, always at a standstill, always an eternity apart. Yet the spell is soon broken as a loud cry erupts in the stillness of the night, followed by more noises as the guests from the party flood into the garden. Knowing it would be disastrous were I to be found with a stranger, I step back, giving him a small headshake. I don't know what you're talking about. One step. Two. I try to put distance between us, yet I can't seem to turn away, walking backwards because something within me cannot stand the thought of not seeing him again. He merely smiles, watching me until I wrench the door to the servants' quarters open and dash inside, heading straight for the stairs leading to my room. Only when his gaze is no longer on me do I release a harsh breath, my body trembling, my heart almost bursting in my chest. Who was he? I whisper to myself, barely paying attention to where I'm going. I've never in my life met someone who affected me so, who made me want to run away from him and towards him at the same time. Yet I trust my instincts, and this duality in my heart is enough to make me keep my distance, if I ever see him again, that is. But why do I feel so sad at the thought of never seeing him again? Shaking myself, I try to make my way up the stairs, though the light is out. The servants must all be working to ensure the event goes smoothly, and likely they forgot to light the candles on this staircase. One hand on the wall, I walk slowly, feeling my way in the darkness. Just as I reach the landing of the first floor, I find myself flat on my front, a hand pulling at my ankle. Let go! I kick with my free foot, turning in an attempt to gain more balance.
You fucking whore!
The words, so full of vitriol, catch me by surprise.
I was promised a virgin bride, not one who's spread her legs for anyone.
He spits at me, pulling me towards him just as his hand comes down on my cheek, the slap leaving me reeling.
What? Were you looking for a fucking? I'll give you a bloody fucking!
Despite the darkness, I realize this must be Lord Clifford, and a dread fills me to the brim. I keep pushing against him, hitting and kicking, and trying my best to escape his hold. When nothing works, I attempt to scream for help, but he doesn't let me get more than a few sounds out before his putrid hand is on top of my mouth, muffling the sounds. Pinning me to the ground, his other hand is roving down my body, searching for the hem of my dress and attempting to push it up. Panic, unlike any other, suffuses my being, tears stabbing at my eyes. No matter how much I struggle, nothing seems to work. Nothing at all. And at this rate... No, he can't touch me. He can't... Help! One echoed word, just as one tear flows down my cheek. One moment, Lord Clifford is wrestling with my dress. The next, he stills on top of me, a spurt of thick, viscous liquid coating my entire face and bodice. Not a second later, a spark of light flares to life, illuminating the entire corridor. Blinking, I can barely move as I come face to face with Lord Clifford's rotten expression, now forever frozen in place. There's a gaping wound on his neck, one that keeps spurting out blood. It's at that moment that I realize the liquid on my face is blood, and Lord Clifford is dead. Gasping, I look up, shocked or maybe not, to see the stranger from outside. He has a small candle in his right hand, his left one dripping with Lord Clifford's blood, yet there's no weapon in sight. How had he... I stare at him, and I cannot seem to find my voice. Maybe I'd screamed too much, though none had been heard. Or maybe... Maybe he did hear.
Can you be quiet?
He asks in a severe tone. I don't know how I find the strength to nod. Perhaps I am still in shock. Or perhaps this is all a nightmare and I'm yet to wake up.
Come.
He says, as he pulls the dead body off me, flinging it aside and giving me his hand, his ungloved hand.
Hurry,
he snaps, impatiently tugging me to his arms, lifting me off the ground and holding me close to his chest. Without my saying anything, he expertly maneuvers us around the servant stairs until he reaches my room. How he knew which door led to my room I do not know, nor do I ask. I am beyond logical connections at this point, though I have no doubt that will come later. In the future, when I will have time to reflect over everything more at length. Closing the door behind us, he places me on the bed before he locks both doors. I'm barely aware of what's happening around, but suddenly I feel a wet cloth against my cheek, slowly wiping the blood away.
Are you all right?
He asks. The man with the white hair and blue, blue eyes. I blink, fighting back tears. Dear God, I was about to be raped. If not for this man in front of me, I would have been raped. Thank you, I whisper, my voice ragged from so much screaming. I don't know how he knew to come, and honestly, I no longer care. I'm only happy that he did, that he saved me. Thank you, I repeat as I cover his hand with mine, stopping his movements. There's worry in his eyes, so much worry for a strange girl. Yet as he looks at me like that, as if my pain was his pain, maybe I'm not a strange girl to him at all. Maybe...
You never have to thank me for anything, Lizzie mine.
He shakes his head lightly.
I should have come earlier. I would have come earlier. But...
You came at the right moment, I interrupt. You saved me, and that's all that matters. I say as a sob breaks through my seemingly strong facade.
Shh.
He whispers, pulling me into his embrace and slowly rocking with me.
I'll always save you, Lizzie mine.
He speaks into my hair, holding me so tightly to his chest, I fear I won't be able to breathe again. But I don't protest. Instead, I bask in that closeness, and the fact that his body heat has a marvelous effect on me, lulling me into a sense of comfort and security unlike I've ever known. If before I felt slightly apprehensive about him, now all I want is to melt in his embrace, merge my skin with his, so I'm never without him again, never without the safety of his arms. When I've calmed some more, he resumes his ministrations, cleaning the blood off my body and instructing me to get rid of the clothes.
We can't leave any evidence behind,
he says as he removes his vest. When he sees my reluctance, he arranges a divider for me to afford me some privacy. I do as he asks, quickly shedding the soiled garments and donning my nightgown instead. When I hand him the clothes, he stuffs them in a makeshift bag. Will you at least tell me your name? I ask, suddenly afraid I won't see him again. He gives me a lopsided smile.
This isn't the last you'll see of me,
he tells me, not for the first time seemingly reading my mind. I nod slowly, yet I can't seem to wrench my gaze from him. Why did I ever think him dangerous? Staring at him like this, all I want is to go to his side, take his hand in mine, and ask him to never let go. In a flash, he is before me.
That time will come,
he murmurs, his knuckles caressing my cheek.
Soon, Lizzie mine, soon you'll be all mine.
Wetting my lips, I find myself lost in the depth of emotion I witness in his eyes. Once more, the question is on the tip of my tongue, yet no sooner do I think of it than he speaks.
Aemon. Aemon D'Artan.
He answers the unspoken question, his voice a soft caress. A smile tugs at my lips, yet as I blink, it's to find him gone, like he was never there. My eyes widen as I look around the room. Aemon? I call out, yet the only reply is the slight echo of the room. The doors are still locked, the windows are untouched. It's like he vanished into thin air. I don't get to ponder it further, as a loud commotion coming from outside claims my attention. Wrapping a robe around me, I open the door, noticing a flurry of servants rushing up and down the stairs. A few seconds later, I spot Mary. My lady! She cries out, rushing to my side. I blink in confusion, and for a moment I'm scared they found Lord Clifford's body and they're coming for me, that I'll hang for murder and... He's dead, she announces, and I freeze on the spot. Your father's dead, she bemoans, recounting how they'd found him collapsed in his study, a heart ailment, they believe. She prattles on, and I merely nod along, only one question in my mind. Aemon, did he... August 1955, Fairydale, Massachusetts. I shoot upright in bed, sweat dripping down my face as my chest constricts, my breathing harsh and out of control. Wildly looking around, it feels as if the walls of the room are closing in on me, suffocating me. The dream, it felt so real. From the clothing to the architecture and people's speech, my speech. My heart is beating wildly in my chest as I try to make sense of it. Never in my life had I been so immersed in a dream, so fully in tune with every little detail. Wiping the sweat off my face, I look down at my hands, almost expecting to see blood on them. Even now I can feel the warmth of the blood on my skin, his gentle touch as he wiped it away. Aemon. How in God's name could I have conjured up someone like him? Someone so... odd, yet familiar, Someone who inspires both fear in me and a sense of security, the likes of which I've never experienced before. All my life I've relied solely on myself, knowing that although I have people who love me in my life, I can only count on myself when it matters most. I've always thought that by being strong, I could be impervious to loneliness. And despite having a part of me that longed for something, an ineffable something, I'd try to push it aside, afraid of disappointment. Yet his embrace, his arms around my body had been like an arrow to the heart, targeting my one weakness and exploiting it. Because it hadn't been just one hug. It had been warmth and a gentleness coupled with a scorching heat that made me think of only one thing. Home. His embrace had felt like home. But the issue is, I've never had a home before. Closing my eyes, I try to recreate his image from before. But now that I am awake, his features are shadowy, almost blurred out. Despite that, the feeling remains. Everything he aroused in me with one touch and one action. My skin tingles with awareness, and heat travels up my neck. I dreamed of a man, clearly a very attractive man, one who didn't seem immune to me either. My eyes squeeze shut with embarrassment, just as I find the strength to get out of bed, going to the bathroom to do my morning ablutions and prepare for the day. As I wash my face, I watch my reflection in the mirror, tracing my features and wondering what he would have seen in me. Dark hair, pale skin, and dark blue eyes. I'm passably pretty, but not the type that inspires unquenchable lust in men. But then, just like a bolt of lightning hitting me, I recall my encounter with Caleb Hale the night before. As if everything falls into place, I can't help but wonder if my dream hadn't been a reaction to that. To the fact that I'd found the man more attractive than any other man I've ever seen in my life. And deep down, though I've been reluctant to admit it to myself, the truth is that he'd made quite an impression on me. He rattled me. And that uneasiness I felt, it was purely my physical reaction to him. At the same time, though, the two men could not be any different. Whereas with Caleb, I'd felt a predominant sense of unease, with Eamon, I'd found the greatest peace. "Get your bearings together, Darcy," I mumble as I slap my cheeks a couple of times. I'm not here to engage in any affairs of the heart, or any other type. My time in Fairydale is limited, and I need to remember my purpose. I can't let any pretty face sway me from that. Especially one that called me a troublemaker and behaved entirely too forward with me. Something that makes me wonder if the entire town had found out about my arrival. More than anything, it tells me I need to have my guard up. I've already witnessed the hidden animosity of the Pierces, and I imagine they won't be the only ones to have an adverse reaction to a stranger in their town. Finishing up my routine, I dress and prepare for the funeral. Grace had lent me a black dress as well, and that should work just fine. I look at my wristwatch, noting there is still some time before Mr. Vaughn will come pick me up. And as my curiosity is getting the best of me, I decide to check the old church once more. Getting out of the house, I lock it before I cross the road. In daylight, the church doesn't look as ominous as before, and I can better admire the architecture and the colored glass. I go straight to the entrance, but as I attempt to open the door, it won't budge. Frowning, I try again, and again, but it's all to no avail. It's locked. It wasn't locked last night. I blink in confusion. Looking around, I shrug my purse on my shoulder as I walk around the church, looking to see if there's any hidden entrance Caleb might have used to play a prank on me. Yet, after two full circles around the building, there's absolutely no other entrance. Baffled, I can only stare at the old edifice, not for the first time feeling as if my mind is playing tricks on me. "Am I going crazy?" I murmur softly to myself. I remember clearly what happened last night. The door had been open, and someone had been playing Bach on the organ. Then I'd heard some steps, after which I'd come across Caleb. Deep in thought, I'm startled by a meowing sound coming from the back of the church. A few steps, and I'm face to face with a cat, a black cat with a tuft of white hair. I freeze on the spot as my mind goes back to my dream and the little creature I'd seen there. It's nearly identical. Before I can get closer to it, however, Mr. Vaughn's voice resounds in the air.
"Miss Darcy, what the hell are you doing there?"
he asks as he strides towards me. "I heard a cat and..."
"What cat?"
he demands when he reaches my side. But as I point to the little ball of black fur, I realize it's already gone. "It must have run away," I whisper in dismay.
"Let's go. We need to get to the funeral on time."
"Wait, who has the key to the church?" I suddenly ask.
"The key to the church?"
he frowns.
"There's no key to the church."
"What do you mean?"
"The church has been sealed shut since the plague. The only way to open it is to blow up the door,"
he explains, his tone almost put off by my question. "But are you certain? I heard the organ playing last night, and when I came to check..." He releases an exasperated sigh as he marches over to the door, his hand on the handle as he tries to wrench it open with all his strength. Just like before, it doesn't budge. "But it can't be," I mumble, staring at the sealed door in shock.
"You must have dreamed about it, Miss Darcy,"
he says gruffly, not looking at me. "That's not true," I protest. "How dare he tell me I dreamed it when I saw it with my own eyes, when I heard the melody with my own ears? Caleb Hale was there, too. He can confirm it," I declare proudly, pushing my chin up. But his reaction is not what I expected. His lips spread into an insidious grin before he laughs out loud.
"Ha! Caleb Hale!"
His amusement doubles, especially as my brows shoot up in confusion.
"He ain't right in the head, Miss Darcy. He's been that way since he came back from the war in Korea. My advice, stay the hell away from him. He's bad news."
"But..." He turns his back to me, walking towards the car parked by the side of the road, thereby ending the discussion, and I'm left more confused than ever. Chapter 5.
"There will be other townsfolk at the funeral, too,"
Mr. Vaughn mentions on the drive towards the cemetery.
"I would encourage you not to be too friendly. Some don't take well to outsiders."
"So I'm supposed to ignore everyone?" I ask, confused.
"Precisely. The fewer people you interact with, the easier it's gonna be for you. Especially the Hales. I'd advise you to stay far away from them."
"But you said only Caleb has... issues. Why the others, too?" His mouth tightens in a flat line, and I note the severity of his expression in the rearview mirror.
"They were business rivals of your father. The Pierces and the Hales have been at each other's throats for generations."
He pauses, looking back at me.
"I wouldn't put it past them to try to use you to get back at the Pierces."
I nod slowly, though the doubts still remain, as does a sense that nothing is what it seems, especially when it comes to the Pierces and Mr. Vaughn. "Anyone else I should not speak to?" I inquire sarcastically.
"As a matter of fact, yes,"
he responds, surprising me.
"The Baileys are friendly with the Hales."
He gives me a list of everyone I should not interact with, topping it off with another warning about Caleb Hale. I almost roll my eyes at him, but then he goes to add something else.
"One more thing. Don't go around telling people silly stories about the church. The last thing we want is for people to question your judgment."
He grumbles away, but all I can think is that he purposefully placed me in a house in the middle of nowhere, across the street from a church where supposedly the bodies of the plague victims had been dumped. A shiver goes down my back. Did I really imagine everything? No, I refuse to believe that. And regardless of Mr. Vaughn's warnings about Caleb Hale, I will question him. At least he should be able to tell me I'm not going crazy. If he's not as crazy as I am, that is. Mr. Vaughn continues to lecture me about the do's and don'ts of the town, almost as if my very presence threatens Fairydale's entire fabric of existence. By the time we reach the cemetery, all I want is to go back and sleep the day away, maybe dream some more of Eamon. If only he could save me from this dreaded day just as he saved me from that creepy man. Alas, I can almost imagine him appearing in a flash before me, as he'd done in my dream, and teleporting me from the funeral. A small chuckle escapes me at the thought, and Mr. Vaughn gives me a harsh glare.
You're not to laugh at the funeral, either. That would be in poor taste, you understand.
He tells me in a serious tone. Of course. I clear my throat, getting out of the car and turning my attention to the matter at hand. This is the worst of it. After the funeral is done, I'll only have to stay for the reading of the will, and then I will be able to leave. Home. A shiver travels down my back at the thought, because really, where is home? Yet I can't ponder that, as Mr. Vaughn leads me through the gates of the cemetery towards the back where a small chapel lies. There are nondescript tombs left and right, and I try to ignore the fact that we're among so many dead. It's daylight. There is no such thing as ghosts. Don't be Catherine, Darcy. Yet the more time I spend in this town, the more I start behaving like her, finding something suspicious in every little action, something otherworldly suspicious. Even after what happened in my childhood, I'd never been a great believer in the supernatural. How could I, when we live in an age of scientific advancement, when a man-made creation can wipe an entire city, if not a country, off the map? As we reach the chapel, I note that everyone is already there. The closed casket is in front of the chapel, the priest walking around it. The Pierce family is by the casket. August is in the middle, while his mother and sister are by his side. On both the left and right side, there are people that I haven't seen before. But it strikes me as odd that they are separated in such a way, and I ask Mr. Vaughn about it. He doesn't look too happy with me at the moment, the man who'd picked me up the other day from the train station all but gone. Progressively, his countenance has become worse and worse, to the point that he doesn't even try to smile at me. All his expressions are severe, like the one he's sporting now.
It doesn't matter now, does it? Like I said, some families have conflicts with others. Just stay by our side, and everything will be fine.
He says, his tone telling me this is the end of the discussion. Sighing, I follow him as he all but positions me right next to the family. Grace gives me the same belligerent look. August has a tight smile on his face, while Vicky barely acknowledges my presence. She's looking at me intently, her gaze boring a hole through me. But as I catch her staring, she surprises me with a wide, almost inviting smile. Glancing around, I make a quick inventory of the people present, unwilling to admit my disappointment when I don't see Caleb anywhere. On the left side, there are about 20 people, some younger, some older. On the right side, however, there are only 4 people. A girl who looks to be my age, accompanied by a man and a woman who I presume to be her parents, and another elderly lady.
If everyone is here, can we commence?
The priest asks, looking at Mr. Vaughn for confirmation, which strikes me as odd. Why wouldn't he inquire with the family of the deceased? Mr. Vaughn nods, and the priest starts with his brief ceremony. For a moment, I think he's going to open the casket for viewing, but I breathe out relieved when he doesn't. I didn't know what he looked like alive. I'm not sure I want to know what he looks like in death. Certainly, I wouldn't want that to be the defining image I have of him. When the priest is done with his little eulogy, he asks the family members to come and say a few words in honor of the deceased. There's a small podium right behind the casket, and Vicky is the first one to go up and make a little speech about her history with Leo Pierce. August is next, followed by Grace, and they all detail what a loving father and extraordinary human being he was. "One that abandoned his child," I mutter under my breath, and Mr. Vaughn is quick to give me a reproachful look. "We also have someone else here today with us," Grace suddenly says before she's about to end her speech. Her gaze lands on me, and a smirk pulls at her lips. "My father had another daughter that he never told us about, but that he decided to include in his will. Darcy, why didn't you say a few words to the man who's going to fund your life from now on?" My eyes widen at the direct appellation as heat travels up my neck. Suddenly, all eyes are on me, my name on everyone's lips as whispers resound in the quiet cemetery. Vicky gives Grace a harsh look while Mr. Vaughn goes to her side, undoubtedly reprimanding her for putting the spotlight on me. Another person seems to join them, a man I'd previously seen sitting on the left side. He's older than Mr. Vaughn, his countenance polished, his looks distinguished. As he addresses Vicky and Mr. Vaughn, both of them immediately stop to listen, denoting him as someone with authority where they are concerned. At that moment, I hope someone will say that it's not necessary for me to speak, but between the argument the Pierces are having amongst themselves and the intense looks I'm getting from all the other attendees, the priest is forced to invite me to the podium to speak. It's not as if I'm a stranger to public.